Sweet is the breath of morn, her rising sweet with charm of earliest birds. Pleasant the sun when first on this delightful land he spreads his orient beams on herb, tree, fruit, and flower, glistering with dew. Fragrant the fertile earth after soft showers, and sweet the coming on of grateful evening mild. Then silent night with this her solemn bird, and this fair moon, and these the gems of heaven, her starry train. But neither breath of morn when she ascends with charm of earliest birds, nor rising sun on this delightful land, nor herb, fruit, flower, glistening with dew, nor fragrance after showers, nor grateful evening mild, nor silent night with this her solemn bird, nor walk by moon or glittering starlight, without thee is sweet. And here, that is between Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, as Milton felt it. And here is an extract from Wordsworth's Immortality Ode. Thou little child, yet glorious in the might of heaven-born freedom on thy being's height, why with such earnest pains dost thou provoke the years to bring the inevitable yoke, thus blindly with thy blessedness at strife? Full soon thy soul shall have her earthly freight, and custom lie upon thee with a weight heavy as frost, and deep almost as life. Custom. Habit can be a good or a bad thing. It is good if we get into good habits about the things we need to be habitual about. But do you really think that we should be habitual about kissing one another or saying I love one another every day if it is just a habit? Surely habits are there in order that we may clear out of our mind the things that can properly be cleared out of it, so that the non-habitual may flourish. And only if the non-habitual flourishes will the frost become a thaw. If we could think, before I plunge into the more terrible part of what I have to say, and I mean, alas, terrible, if we could think that, after all, the main enemy is bad habit, whether it is the bad habit of vice, or whether, which it is also vicious to be, the bad habit of custom, where custom is not required. And certainly, in the deepest of human relations, custom is out of place. So, having said that preliminarily about custom, let me now say something which should help you to understand the kind of way I'm trying to take this subject this morning. The Lord said to Martha that Mary had taken the better part. But ask yourself these two questions. Would he have said it at all if Martha hadn't fussed? And secondly, would he always be saying it? One of the invidious things we do about the gospel is to erect it into rigid principles and into a kind of Mosaic law once all over again. But the right way to follow the master is the way he teaches. And what he does is to teach by saying unique things and doing unique things in every occasion that comes up. Thus, for example, it is obviously a relic of barbarism to stone adulteresses. But at the same time, it would be utterly untrue to derive from the story of the woman taken in adultery, which no gospel could find place for, and it got late tatched on to John because they were so uneasy about it, The woman taken in adultery, it would be utterly wrong to erect that into a principle that adulteresses, or for that matter adulterers, should be forgiven automatically. Surely the answer is this: if there had been only one sister there, then that sister would have had to do the preparation for the meal and the listening to the Lord. And surely there must also be times when Mary has to do the domestic work and Martha has to listen. And surely the person of all persons who knows that perfectly well is the Lord himself, who knows that better than any of us. Please let us, and this applies to practically everything I say this morning, please let us remember that not only is the Lord unique, he is the only historian. He's the only hero in history. There are no other heroes in history. To call anybody else a hero is blasphemous to him. That he, in his uniqueness, teaches us that quality which we need, which restores us from habit and enables us to live. What I have to say this morning, however, is mainly about the load of frost from another point of view. And then I hope to have time to say something about a thaw as well. When the Lord atones for us, he atones in an infinite atonement which can atone for anything that needs to be atoned for. But you know, we have to look at this business of atonement not simply from the point of view of the atonement of every individual soul that ever existed. We also have to think of it in terms of ourselves as the human race and what we have done. And what I have to say this morning is principally about what we have done and how we can undo it. About God-given marriage, which was instituted in the Garden of Eden, and outside the scriptures is most beautifully described by Milton in the best book of Paradise Lost, which is not book 9, which deals with the fall, which is not as important to us as it was to Milton, but book 4, which describes the early married life of Adam and Eve. However, it is not long in terms of human history before Cain kills Abel. It is not long before Noah gets drunk. It is not long before we are faced with the problems of families in that greatest book about all families, namely Genesis, which is held up to us as an example to ourselves, in which we must find likeness to ourselves. Not a series of wooden statues erected to perfection, but a series of stories about real families, and in particular one real family, studied in a way that we shall never find it studied anywhere else except in the scriptures. Because if there's one thing that is absolutely certain to us in our church, we have the unexampled opportunity of remembering that the scriptures are the finest of all literature, that we shall never find finer literature anywhere else, and that therefore in the scriptures we have the means of judging all other literature whatsoever, and that we should so judge it. Because that, among other things, is what the scriptures are for. If you felt when you were picking up a piece of trash, if you remembered, and most things that are printed are trash, remember, if you felt suddenly to yourselves, how does this compare with the scriptures? Would you not throw it into the fire instead of continuing to read it? I had a young man come to me 2 or 3 days ago and said, should I read this? And I looked at it and said, certainly not. So he threw it in the waste paper basket. That was sensible. I looked at the last page of the wretched book first to say, I pointed out to him, you know, that's the way you can find out whether to read a book or not. Read the last paragraph or two of it. You'll soon know. Well, that was a divagation. Now let me get back to my main theme, which is what we have done to marriage in history. All I can do this morning is to remind you of certain things. My sources are old-fashioned somewhat, but nothing has really, in my view, ever exceeded Westermarck's History of Human Marriage, that brilliant Finn. I'm not concerned with the depths of anthropology on this subject. I'm merely concerned with what we have and can say about it and see about it from the historical and social point of view. Because the deeper point of view is not to be found in books of anthropology or psychology. It is to be found in the scriptures themselves, and above all in the histories of families that we have in the Book of Mormon and in Genesis. Also perhaps David and his family. But they are all, I think you must agree, examples not merely of success, but of failure, and the two very closely intertwined, which is what our lives are like. The first thing I have to say is that the institution of marriage, very early in human history, was made into a social institution of the wrong kind. Now, don't get me wrong, marriage is above all a social institution, and married people are responsible to society for themselves and their family, as they are responsible to God. And the family is the essential cell and unit of the state, and if it failed, the state will fail, as states are now failing. That is all perfectly true. But society took the family and made it into something very different from what the Lord intended. And ever since in history, there has been a pendulation between the institution of marriage as a social thing and the desires of human beings, which are unsatisfied in that institution. And so, constantly, we have the swing of the pendulum between the insistence on institutionalization, which was still dominant in the 19th century, and then the reaction against it, which takes us into promiscuity as a reaction against that rigidity of institutionalization. And so you get these two opposite poles, on the one hand, of marriage as an economic unit and romance and promiscuity. The romantic is a reaction against the excess of institutionalization. And whether we believe it or not, it is still true that we are still in the romantic movement in the West. We have not got rid yet of its trammels, although it has now been going for a good 209 years. We have, I think, in honor to ourselves, to remember what history tells us about how marriage was made in the upper classes in the first place and then by the bourgeoisie into an institution for increasing the economic power of the family. And this, of course, is something from which the whole family has suffered. The man, the woman, and the children have all suffered from this appalling reduction of marriage to an economic transaction. So that in the Middle Ages, for example, you've got this ridiculous deep cleft between, on the one hand, the accruement of lands to a family by means of marriage, and on the other hand, the romantic excesses of chivalric love and its necessary association with celibacy in the troubadour tradition, and the breaking away from that tradition into adultery, which was almost inevitable in a situation of that kind. Adultery, in fact, is there as a permanent condition of the upper classes throughout history because marriage has become an economic covenant. And I think if we do understand that, we can understand how much we have already escaped from in current society. But the trouble is, in escaping from the one, we run into the other. There's Scylla on the one hand and Charybdis on the other. It's always that kind of way with excess. Now, this habit of adultery, which has been a habit of the upper classes since the year Dot, and you only have to look at Greek literature to see that, and for that matter, the scriptures too, has become, during the last 150 years or so, increasingly, also a middle-class habit. I'm assuming, of course, that the marriage contract has been able to mean very little in the lower classes for most of history on account of the economic subjection under which they suffered. But the peasantry and the bourgeoisie had a certain amount of permanency in the sense of marriage and a certain amount of happiness. As reflected in the literature, you can see that bourgeois families in the 17th and 18th century, and even in the 19th, although by that time the grim spectre of a black-clad father in trousers began to obtrude too heavily, fact remains that there was a good deal of happiness in bourgeois marriage during that time. But now that has all changed, of course, and marriage is no longer a standard custom any more than it is anything like what the Lord had intended it to be, which was not as a standard custom, but a sacramental union between two for the benefit of all. I could go through a number of examples in which the world turns round and savages, I'm using it as a verb, and savages those unusual individuals who shone out as having a special relationship with one another, something like what the Lord intended. You may think that Eloisa and Abelard was a question of fornication, but if you try and think of the ideological situation in which they were placed and the necessary celibacy enforced on Abelard and the necessary family requirements enforced on Eloisa, and if you think also of their individual effort to make what there was a real marriage between the two of them into a sacrament, you can see what exceptional people those people of the 12th century were. And there have been occasional couples like that throughout history. One of the great points about Shakespeare's Antony and Cleopatra is, and this accounts in part for the extraordinarily high-level ending, it is that this union of persons takes what the world regards as a vicious course, and which the Lord can't fail to regard as a vicious course, because, as the play reminds us over and again, the Lord is to come within about 30 or 40 years. Christianity is round the corner. And in the middle, dispensation, the ideal of marriage was once again placed before us, only once again to be obscured by the eruption of that Gnostic heresy of the first and second century, which in its deliberate split of spirit and body created a situation in which celibacy was elevated to a greater virtue than marriage. And this is probably, of all things, the worst element of heresy in the development of the apostate church. And we have not yet totally got rid of it in our own church. If we had, this conference wouldn't be necessary. I think it was Hugh Nibley who once said the main task of the church up until about 1920 was to try and re-educate the Calvinists in the church into Mormonism. Because they'd all come in, you see, from Baptists and Congregationalists and Presbyterians with these appalling Calvinistic deterministic views, this split between spirit and body, this Gnostic heresy. So that, as I was saying to Chauncey Riddle the other day, we've got, in our theology, we've got spirit, and we've got body, and we've got soul. And we know that the union of the first two creates the third. But when we come to adjectives, we've got corporeal and we've got spiritual. But the word spiritual has to do in our church still for A, an adjective to spirit, and B, an adjective for soul. Because you can't use soulful in that sense, it has a different clang. And the word soul itself, of course, is very difficult for us nowadays because of the blacks. But another reason why I point out that this education is still badly needed, so that we should understand the liberation of our own church on this matter and its higher teaching than any other teaching on marriage has ever been offered during the whole time of the apostate church. We note to this morning, and that's why I began with it, that the presence of so few men here, and I wouldn't say it merely for myself, because I could see it quite natural that men might absent myself when I was talking, but I have been to other meetings and they've absented themselves from those too. And you know, not being somewhere is a choice, just as deciding not to act is a choice. We cannot avoid choosing, whatever it may be, in our life, one way or another. All our actions are moral or immoral, and those of you whose husbands are not here might well go home and say, well, you've committed an immoral act today, my dear, you were not at the conference. Let me go on to my next point, which I want to elaborate more from what has happened during the last 200 years. The Romantic movement brought together a situation in which middle classes wanted comfort and dreams from the rather pedestrian life they were living as the result of the development of the Industrial Revolution, with certain ideals which they developed from other portions of history, and particularly from the Middle Ages. And they made of it a certain way of looking at human love between man and woman in a very ambiguous way. Now, they were not, of course, the first to find this situation. Those of us who know something about Indian painting, for example, in the 18th century, are very interested to find in it, in a totally different society, but a society which arranges its marriages, an idealization of non-marital love of a romantic kind in terms of escape. Escape to the forest of the loving couple, etc., etc. Repeated over and over again. And of course, you know that the country which produces most films in the world is India. And a great many of those films are about romantic love, again, as a reaction. Now, this is, I think, an important thought, because it means that the ideas of the Romantic movement about the relation of man and woman have not confined themselves by any means to the West, but for reasons of human need have spread all over the world, and for all I know may now be developing in New Guinea, because that is now an independent country, which I have visited. I saw no signs of romantic love in New Guinea when I was there, but things happen very quickly nowadays. My wife was with me and she's shaking her head. I don't know what she means by that. I think she saw no signs either, probably. But the point is relevant, because I'm quite sure there are young men and young women now in even New Guinea who are adopting these ideas. Now, in Anglo-Saxon countries, there was a certain amount of compromise about romantic love and marriage.
And you can see it reflected in your literature in such different things as Nathaniel Hawthorne and Louisa M. Olcott. And incidentally, I think Louisa M. Olcott is one of the best American writers. The first one I ever read at the age of 7 and 8, and I shall go on reading her happily until I die, I hope. One of my colleagues on campus here is in the habit of saying that nowadays the only literature that is any good at all in the West is children's literature, because it still preserves some vestige, children's literature, of proper moral standards. And I think that that goes very near to being the truth. And I find myself, as I grow older, reading more and more children's literature, because the rest is practically unbearable, unless I confine myself to pre-1800. Same with the music, for that matter. Then, this middle-class audience, middle-class readers, they had this kind of literature before them. And it created the most astonishing paradoxes, which we still have not resolved. And I may say that the reason that we have not resolved them lies much deeper than anything that a woman's movement has yet really tackled. You take this situation, the sisters Bronte and their drunken brother in the parsonage at Haworth in Yorkshire. And you take the impact on them of the satanic poet Byron. You take the impact on Europe of Byron. You may say, well, of course, it's snobbism. He was a lord and he wrote well, and not many lords do write well, so this is a chance. But there's more to it than that. Byron appealed. Wordsworth was a far more moral poet, in spite of his illegitimate child. But the influence of Wordsworth has never, in Europe, or even for that matter in Britain, even today, been as strong as that of Byron. Over and over again, we see in the preferences of the middle class for literature during the last 150 years the evidence of not merely hypocrisy but despair, and above all hypocrisy and despair about this most central of human considerations, marriage. Why otherwise do we find the middle classes so eager and willing for the last 150 years to read so much literature about adultery and fornication, and then, of course, latterly, about all the various perversions? It must be something which is fundamentally wrong with most people's married life, because, after all, a great many of the people who read this kind of literature are married people. And that's where I come to the main point that I have to make today. The level of education may not be very high in our church in terms of the ordinary idea of culture, but it is very much higher than the rest of the world in terms of what we accept as moral standards. And if moral standards are not fundamental to culture, I don't know what is. I hold, as all Mormons should hold, and if they don't, they should go home and think about it, that the aesthetic and the moral are indissoluble. That if a thing is good, it must also be beautiful and true. If it is beautiful, it must also be good and true. And if it is true, it must also be good and beautiful. And if you cannot unite those categories in your mind, then you need integration. Those categories need to be united under one grand religious category, and it is the religious category that unites it. There is so much thinking in the world about social problems, including the social problems of women, which are very serious ones. So much thinking from the point of view of sociology, psychology, philosophy, literature itself, etc. But these are all the philosophies of men. And the relationship of the sexes, which is, after all, the relationship of human beings, What we are required to do is to look at one another as human beings in the first place. The relationship between the sexes is one which, if it is not religious, is not satisfactory. If it is not permanent, is not satisfactory. If it is not pure, it is not satisfactory. We don't know, perhaps, as much as we need to know about it, but such experiences I've had of illicit relationships is that illicit relationships do not produce harmony or happiness or even physical satisfaction, if you can distinguish between that and the other kind of satisfaction, which I don't believe you can. And therefore, the promiscuous world is getting more and more uptight, tense, unhappy, and undecided. And this applies, of course, even more to the women than the men, because if one thing is obvious throughout all history, it is that men have nearly all to gain from a permanent relationship in life, but are prepared not to recognize it. But women have clearly recognized it about themselves for the most part until our own time. As my mother used to say, and I owe it to her, I suppose, therefore, it seems to me, she said, that men are naturally polygamous and women are naturally monogamous. And I used to say to her, does that mean you want me to have several wives? And she said, not necessarily, but what she did mean was, of course, that men are more prepared to deny the fundamental value of marriage than women are. And that ought not to be so in our church, and may not be so. And yet, look at all the women who come to women's conference. Well, it's the men who need to come to women's conference, just as it's the women who need to come to those appalling conferences that I can envisage in the future, which will be men's conferences. And here I come, I'm just thinking about the amount of tobacco smoke and beer and things of that kind at men's conferences. It's bad enough already. Now, let me come back to this business then, which is my final theme, about human beings. Because this is the point at which much clarification is badly needed. I've just been rereading, at the instance of a friend, Dorothy Sayers' two essays about the relationships of men and women, written back in the 30s, but prophetic in their way. What she insists on, essentially, in those two essays, and she was a highly intelligent woman, one of the best intelligences of that time. I have had the honor of meeting her and having her company for a few days once, and she was a person full of common sense. I've rarely met anybody so full of common sense as Dorothy says. Perhaps she had all the more common sense because, of course, she has contributed towards escape literature more than most women. But there we are. The woman who wrote Nine Tailors is a woman of common sense, was a woman of common sense. What she has to say fundamentally is this. In all social relations, we are required to look at one another as human beings. Now, that does not mean that sex is not fundamental, because in our church, above all places, we know that sex is from everlasting to everlasting. But the fact remains that what you ostensibly and deliberately do, and what you do, as it were, fundamentally without noticing it, are not two separate things, but they need to be in their place. I was talking to someone the other day about Jane Austen's novels. It was a boy of 15, incidentally, who was extremely interested in them. And we were talking about what Jane Austen does not talk about. And the answer is, Jane Austen does not talk about what she knows her readers can supply for themselves. So we went through the heroes and heroines in Jane Austen's novels and said, well, now, where may we posit passion between these people? Because he wanted to know about this. He was puzzled by it. And we came to a very easy agreement about it, that it was there by implication the whole time. There is something deeply wrong, and it's a curious paradox that it was D.H. Lawrence who said it. There's something deeply wrong about a society that needs to be explicit about sex. It's a survival of that Calvinism. It's a survival of that Puritanism. It's these people who are determined to be puritanical in their anti-puritanicality. That means, if you like, fanatical. I don't know quite how else to say it. But to be fanatical about anything is obviously wrong, and to be fanatical about sex is obviously wrong. It leads to things like the tearing to pieces of Orpheus by the Bacchantes. A terrible myth, but a real one in the sense that it corresponds to something profound in human nature. A band of women get together and tear the poet to pieces. You know, we are nearer in our own time to that ancient Greek situation than any situation has been since. We are recurring to a profound barbarism in the West. And our church is perhaps the only consolidated, integrated way against it. The Roman Catholic Church has, after all, broken down and is definitely making efforts to save itself all the time by making compromises here and compromises there. And it will continue to do it. We do not make compromises. So, let me get together what I have to say about human beings and try and say something about it in terms of spirit and body and soul, which is the way in which our church talks about it instead of talking about sex. The reason why people are so anxious nowadays to be explicit about sex is because they have been inhibited in the past, and they have swung over my pendulum image once again. But we have no reason for that kind of inhibition in our church, because we have restored and had restored to us the Christian doctrine of marriage, as preached in the gospel, as practiced by the favored few during the apostate church, and as revealed to us in this, the last of times. It should be, therefore, easier for us to deal with these problems than it is for the outside world. And I think it is quite likely that there are many thousands of human beings within the Mormon Church who are happy and fulfilled and determined to do their part in these things. But of all the places in the world, and this is my final point, of all the places in the world where the church is threatened by the surrounding culture, this is the place. Because most of us in other countries are under no illusion about the total difference between the church and the surrounding culture. Whether we come from Britain or Switzerland, or whether we come from Latin America, it's the same. We know that Satan dominates in the surrounding culture. And American Mormons are extremely reluctant to admit this. And yet, with your mass media, with your technical ability, with your money, and with your resources, Your culture is better able to express the satanic than any other culture in the world, including the Soviet Union and China, because they are inefficient, and you are still not inefficient in this country. You are still efficient. So the satanism of your culture is under the domination of your efficiency. And so this country has the principal responsibility for the dissemination of good or bad ideas in the world. And I have seen American films in America and Asia and Latin America and Europe and Africa. And they all, almost all, have the same bad message. Please, in our knowledge of having the truth in our church, let us remember that that truth is not in our surrounding society. It is there on principle in the American Constitution. It is potentially there in American practice, but it is not there in American practice. And it is not there either in your reactions to the situation, whether they be blacks or Chicanos, or a specific spearhead by women. These are all offshoots of the surrounding culture. The macho behavior of men has to do with the surrounding culture. And the anti-macho behavior of women, which also becomes macho behavior, is part of the surrounding culture. It is not part of the church. And it is not part of the church either that we should have sympathy with the movement, although we may have sympathy with the people in the movement, because the movement is sinful, though the people in it may be the sinners. But we must not put the burden upon them. We must point out the sin, but not the sinners. But the sin is there. And though the sin of men is greater, because they on the whole have created the abominable civilizations in which we have to live, the task of women remains what it always has been, as the higher moral being, to try and establish in their families a standard which will resist the appalling attacks of the world which on the whole men have made. If we can recognize that, surely women in the church can go forward in their task of being human beings alongside their husbands, their fathers, their brothers, in this effort to make our church the one resource of humanity that remains against the oncoming tides of evil. Now, I'm sorry to end on a note of this kind, but it is the note on which one has to end. We have to fight evil every day of our lives, every minute of our lives, in ourselves and in others. And in that fight, what is more important than that husband and wife should stand together in harmony in order to see that what is wrong with them both and what is wrong with the world is not sexual distinction, but sin? And there are enormously important sins that run right the way through history in which even macho behavior is merely a poor reflection of mass murder, which has been there from the beginning and is not an invention of the 20th century. Mass murder, for which also the Lord has, in that infinite atonement, to atone. Thank you.